Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And we're going to be talking to Mahdi Nassim-Roya, who has written an article in globalresearch.ca about the events in Syria. He's written also recently about the removal of Mr. Morsi, President Morsi in Egypt. All these things are related, but we're going to find out more about what's going on there. We think it's very, very important. I'm sure our listeners do as well. And then, of course, at 5:30, we'll be talking to GazaArc.org in the form of David Heap. They have been impacted, of course, by the developments in Egypt and in Syria. Inevitably, this is going to be affecting their work. So we look forward to doing that. Phil, you have an announcement. I do. I'm sorry. I'm the one who's got the announcement. At a different book list coming up on Thursday, July 25 at 7 p.m., 746 Bathurst, Dr. Carolyn Cooper, author and leading scholar on Jamaican culture, with her new edited book, Global Reggae. So that's Global Reggae, Dr. Carolyn Cooper, and she's a leading scholar on Jamaican culture. And that's Thursday, July 25 at 7 p.m., a different book list, 746 Bathurst Street, Toronto. Just in the moments before here, a kind of important headline that I was struck by. Jimmy Carter was apparently interviewed by a German newspaper, or he attended a conference which they were present at. And he says, we don't have a functioning democracy. And someone pointed out, that's kind of an important remark. He said that's in light of this NSA business. The story there is that it wasn't reported widely. The word is getting around. And of course, we're all saying, well, we have an internet, and that's why everybody says, alternative radio, alternative news, in order to know that the former president of the United States has made this remark. You have to search. We do have time for Phil. Let's tell people the 90. Is it 90 or 80? You'd give me the number.
I think it's over 90. It's over 90 writers. Yeah.
Prominent Canadian authors have signed a statement. Tell us about that.
So the statement, and it's sponsored by several organizations. I have a copy from the Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. And it is addressed to the Israeli government, and it concerns the decision by the Israelis to evict about 1,000 Palestinians who live in the occupied West Bank from their homes in order to establish an Israeli army firing zone, and also a separate project, which is to destroy some Bedouin villages in order to build a settlement.
Now, what's the statement say?
The statement says, we, the undersigned, urge Israeli leaders to heed the call by David Grossman, Amos Oz, Ab Yeshua, and 21 other Israeli writers to halt immediately and permanently the eviction of about 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in various villages in South Hebron, West Bank, and then in parenthesis, occupied Palestinian territory, in order to clear land for an Israeli army firing zone. These Palestinian villages have inhabited their homes for several centuries. Evicting them would violate international law and cause extreme hardship. We also urge you to reject the Begin-Prower plan currently before the Knesset, which, if fully implemented, would result in the forced relocation of between 20,000 and 70,000 Bedouin citizens of Israel from their homes in the Negev. Mm-hmm. This plan would also result in the destruction of up to 35 unrecognized Bedouin villages. We ask you to heed the European Parliament's call to withdraw the plan, which violates the constitutional rights of the Bedouin to property, dignity, and equality. The actions planned are manifestly unjust and will gravely damage Israel's international reputation. And then it's signed by
The organization,
Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East.
Terrific.
Yeah.
And so who are some of the people on this list?
This is quite a list. Old and young, conservative and progressive, known and unknown. It's an amazing list. Dr. Gabor Maté, this is in no particular order, Alberto Manguel, Gary Geddes, Hirome Goto, Fred Waugh, who's a poet, Order of Canada, Camilla Gibb, Michelle Tremblay, Wason Choi, Susan Musgrave.
And you haven't even said Margaret Atwood yet.
I haven't got to Margaret Atwood yet. Or Yann Martel. Vincent Lam, one of Canada's brightest upcoming writers. Gail Zoe Garnett. Carmen Aguirre. Ken Klonsky. Silver Donald Cameron. Susan Crean, there's Yann Martel's name. Mm-hmm. I'm on page three now. Margaret Atwood, Lawrence Hill, Naomi Klein, Charles Ferran, Jane Urquhart, Rohinton Mystery, Nino Ritchie, and John Ralston Saul.
That's a taste. Well, bless those Canadian authors who've done that. We're going to be talking right now to a Canadian author. We have to get his name on this list. Mahdi Nazimroya, are you there, Mahdi?
Hi, Phil. I'm here.
Good.
How are you?
Very good. You have an article which is being featured several places. I saw it at globalresearch.ca. The title is From Turkey with Love. Good heavens, my handwriting. Another Israeli attack on Syria. Let's just start with that. What is the connection here? I mean, I have heard there's been more than one attack, hasn't there, in recent months by Israel against Syria, which is contending at this moment with mercenaries and foreign-sponsored fighters, etc. What's Israel's role in this, and how does Turkey come into it?
All right. Well, we don't know exactly what happened in the Syrian port of Latakia, which the Russians used and the Iranians have also used before. Mm-hmm. But there was some sort of explosion. At least these rumors started about this, and the sources are Israeli. Almost all the sources involved here are Israeli, including the one that claims a Turkish base was used, including even the Israeli press is quoting Turkish officials. So we don't know exactly if the base was used 100%, but we do know that Turkey and Israel do collaborate. There's no question about that. I mean, there are minor differences, but at the end of the day, they are allies. Mm-hmm. And they're comrades in arms against the Syrians. They're both working against Syria, so we shouldn't be too pessimistic, or I mean, too skeptical about this. Sorry, that's mm-hmm. the proper word. We shouldn't be too skeptical mm-hmm. because the Turks and the Israelis have coordinated military maneuvers at the same time. I mean that. Obama went in March of this year to Israel, and he spoke to Netanyahu. And in 20 minutes, all of a sudden, Turkey and Israel declare that, okay, our diplomatic row is over.
Yes.
And, you know, the appalling part is that those people who died on the Mavi Marmara, mm-hmm. their blood meant nothing. But, you know, Erdogan and his foreign minister and his cabinet, they're afraid to tell the Turkish people the truth. So they pretend they're.
But by the way,
they're not.
Yes, that has damaged his reputation. Surely, I mean, the Turkish people watching this. I mean, after all, he kind of played them for suckers, right? He made a great show of how angry and how he was going to get an apology and he was going to get compensation, and then overnight he doesn't do anything. He just takes a flip flop. I mean, the Turks are rather proud. Nation, as I understand it.
That's diplomatic rhetoric. I mean, you know, Erdogan, the United States and many other powers, including Britain, France, and the Gulf dictatorships, the sheikdoms there, they've been trying to prop Erdogan up as a hero amongst the people of the Middle East and the Arabs. That's why he took these stances on Palestine. You know, in Davos, at the World Economic Forum, he challenged Shimon Peres, in reality, when he's telling the Turkish people we should kick Israel out of the United Nations, he never cut his diplomatic ties with Israel. It really was just talk, because if he really wanted to, he was talking about expelling Israel from the United Nations. but he wouldn't expel the Israeli ambassador from Turkey. it was really talk. I mean,
well, that must be something to do with his domestic problems, that he is just not a credible man anymore, is he?
No, the Turkish government has lied to the utmost degree when it comes to Israel, and they've lied to the utmost degree when it comes to Syria. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, they allowed NATO to bring missiles in. They said, oh, these missiles will not be pointed at the Iranians or the Russians. That's what they're there for.
And well, as well as Iraq. Who would you point them at?
I know. They sent a spy mission into Syria for NATO, you know, and then they say it was an honest accident. You know, the plane only went there for a few minutes. But they lied. The technical facts, the facts on the ground showed that they totally lied about that. And even when they're members of their own media, the Turkish media, because there's still brave people in Turkey that are willing to oppose Erdogan and his government, when they come out with the facts and a counter-narrative, what they're called enemies of the state, and then Erdogan and the AK party, they try to change the constitution and the laws in Turkey to censor the media. You know, Turkey has the most journalists in jail out of any other country in the world. So when they demonize countries like Iran and China, we should remember that one of our closest allies, NATO allies, Turkey is the place where most journalists are put in jail, sometimes for offending the dignity of an official. You can be arrested for that. Artists have been arrested for political satires.
Shouldn't he have to prove that he has? Shouldn't he have to prove that he has some dignity to be offended?
No, Erdogan has no dignity. I mean, the man has outright lied. He's flip-flopped on a lot of issues. He's used the Palestinian issue to gain basically political points at home and abroad. Their neo-Ottomanism policies failed miserably. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood is out of the picture. The only place they're basically standing in is Tunisia. In Libya, they didn't fare too well. Well, we know what happened in Egypt. In Syria, they've lost. I mean, this so-called revolution, this insurgency, it's finished. There'll be some fighting continuing, you know, specifically around the Aleppo area. But, I mean, it's done. The regime change project's over. Qatar is now questioning its investment in the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar itself is, you know.
Yeah, by the way, that is a very important crisis, and you put your finger on it. This is Mahdi Nazimroya, by the way, the author of The Globalization of NATO. You could read articles at globalresearch.ca and rt.com. I have seen the articles as well. They are really playing with fire here because they have an issue with Kurds, and there is a claim that they intend to try to establish an autonomous zone inside Syria, either based on Kurdishness or a second one based on Islamist, some kind of Salafi regime. Do you think anybody's going to be able to pull that off? And what do you make of that?
Well, I can tell you that the government of Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian government, is going to allow the Syrians, Kurds, to establish a degree of autonomy in northeastern Syria. And the reason for that is to keep the country united. When this fighting broke out, the Kurds didn't side with the al-Nusra or the Syrian National Council or later the Syrian National Coalition. The Kurds didn't side with them. In fact, all the media reports that said this stuff, they were basically lying. I'll be very frank. The Kurds have not sided with them. They don't want to be involved in this project. They do want autonomy. They do want more rights. The Kurds have been suppressed historically suppressed as minorities within the Middle Eastern countries that they're.
And by the way, just specifically on that, in terms of the status of Kurds in the region, they do function as well, probably better than most of the neighboring states, right, outside Syria. In other words, they receive a harder time in Turkey and elsewhere than they do in Syria.
Turkey was the absolute worst one. I mean, I can tell you that the place where Kurds have fared the most the best off in, I would say, is Iran. And that's because the Kurds are an Iranian ethnicity. They're related to the Persians. Mm-hmm. Their languages are almost the same. They can understand each other. They have the same cultural heritage, you know.
Yes, and some of the Iranian leaders have actually been from that stock, right?
Yeah, many of them. The one of the presidential candidates, the mayor of Tehran, is a Kurd. I mean, Iran's a multi-ethnic country, and Kurds are historically the oldest. The history of Iran starts with the Kurds, with the Median Empire. That's the old name for the Kurds. Mm-hmm. But after that, of course, now in northern Iraq, Kurds are faring well because of the autonomous region there. Mm-hmm. So I think those two are the best. The worst has been Turkey. Turkey's tried to... It was against the law to speak Kurdish in Turkey. It was mm-hmm. against the law to even say you're a Kurd. You had to call yourself a mountain Turk. Yeah. They tried to suppress the entire identity of the Kurds. And that's martial law in Kurdistan. That's southeastern Turkey. I mean, there was military courts. Kurdish music was illegal. You can go to jail for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why the Kurds started revolting against the Turkish government. It was absolutely unacceptable fascist treatment of the Kurds. And they are one of the largest groups in Turkey. They're about 30% of the population minimum. Mm-hmm. 20-25%, like mm-hmm. they are a very large plurality in Turkey, mm-hmm. and you know the treatment that they've seen was trying to erase an entire identity, and akin to what was happening, what has been happening in Canada to our Indigenous people, how we've tried to get them to assimilate, and that was the Turkish policy, and honestly, this reactionary Turkish policy was a result of the World War One, because they tried to destroy Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. There was a foreign project to destroy Turkey, and as a means of protecting the state, this is how this reactionary nationalism took over.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya. His book is The Globalization of NATO. By the way, Mahdi, you're going to be also writing. You have a new book, I understand. It's going to be focused on the Libyan developments, is that right?
Yes, it's going to be focused on NATO's involvement in the war in Libya, and as well as more broadly speaking, the African continent and places like Mali and Niger mm-hmm. and Algeria, and the effects of the war in Libya had on them.
Attack on Africa.
Yeah, it's the recolonization of Africa, or a second scramble for Africa.
Yeah, which is well underway. Now, Mahdi, I want to know... I was reading the interview, and you must have seen it, with President Assad, and he said, well, they've tried this. They tried one game with us, and then they tried a second one. He said, but now they've left. Their only choice now is to come after us themselves. And when he says them, he's referring to Britain, France, the United States. And they do. There's a little rhetoric in that way coming out of London, Washington, Paris. How close are we to that, and do you think that they will back off?
I don't think they'll launch a war again. I don't think they'll start a war against Turkey. I'm very skeptical about that. I'm sorry, yes, Syria, because, I mean, launching a war against Syria will have drastic regional and international consequences. We can see that the Russians have not backed down an inch on Syria, and they won't. They understand fully what Syria means to them. Syria is an ally of theirs. Mm-hmm. It's also an important ally of Iran. The Iranians, for them, their view is Syria is one close stepping stone to war with Iran. I mean, and Lebanon would be dragged into this. You can see that for Hezbollah, this is part of an existential struggle, you mm-hmm. know. And we can see, by the way, since we're talking about this, they're clamping down against Hezbollah as well. Now there's sanctions against Lebanese businessmen in Africa, which they believe could be sending money to Hezbollah. You know, they're mm-hmm. going after the Lebanese economy as well. We're going to see more sanctions against Hezbollah mm-hmm. and Lebanon. They're kicking all the Shiite Lebanese and even non-Shiite Lebanese outside of the Gulf states because they're sending remittance back to Lebanon. So they're trying to put And now the European Union has declared the military wing of Hezbollah a terrorist organization. The entire EU has declared that.
Yes.
I just learned about that today. And, you know, we can see that this campaign against Syria is not only targeting the Syrians, it's targeting the Russians, the Iranians, yes. Hezbollah, Iraq, and even the Chinese. Like, all of them know what the fall of Syria would mean for them.
Yes.
So I don't think the Iranians, the Russians, and many other countries would just stand by and watch Syria get attacked. I mean, and we have to remember also that the military in Syria, although it's not, we can criticize it for how it's performed against guerrilla insurgency, you know, most militaries have a hard time fighting against guerrilla insurgencies. I mean, it's not the same. You don't just bomb a place. You know, you have to go into house to house. That's what's been taking a long time. Anyways, although it might look like it's struggling in a fight against, or was struggling in this guerrilla war, when it comes to conventional warfare, it's a totally different story. I mean, it still is one of the strongest Arab armies. And with the support of Iran and Russia, I don't think that NATO wants a war against it. Even though I know that the Pentagon has said that we are considering military options now, I just think it's psychological pressure.
Yeah. This is Mahdi Nazim Roya. His article is from Turkey with Love, another Israeli attack on Syria. Now, you also wrote a piece about Egypt, and I think your argument basically was that the military was afraid of where this mass movement against Morsi was headed. In other words, they thought they might have revolutionary conditions, and that they were going, and they decided to head that off to sort of nip it in the bud. Is that the thesis?
That's a re-argument, actually. I want to add the word re, because that's the same thing they did with Mubarak. They removed Mubarak, and then they made a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. They made a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, they slowly helped. Well, of course, they didn't exactly make the deal right away. There was still tension between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood. There always has been. Because let me be very frank, the military is the old regime. The old regime and the military are the same entity.
Mm-hmm.
All the cabinet ministers are ex-generals or generals in Mubarak's regime. Mubarak himself was a general. His prime ministers were generals. Sadat was a general. Always been the military.
Well, you could say since Farouk, right?
Egypt's been the first civilian government is Morsi. And they removed Morsi because the people, some things would have spilled out of hand and there would have been a revolution. And if there's a revolution or a revolt of that nature, of course the military as a state institution is going to be restructured. Mm-hmm. But this is a corrupt armed forces. It's not like the Lebanese military, which is essential to national unity in Lebanon. I mean, as an institution, the Lebanese military, be it, it has a lot of flaws, is something that's keeping the state together. I mean, but the Egyptian military, aside from the lower-ranking officers and the enlistees, I mean, the non-commissioned members, you know, the privates, the corporals, the sergeants, the captains, the low-ranking people, the people at the top, they're all corrupt. They own 40%+ of the economy. They own the hotels. They make money off the transactions with the Suez. They're absolutely corrupt. I mean, they're looking out for their own interests, and that's why. And they, just like the Obama administration.
Represented a threat.
The Obama administration is in the same boat. They supported Morsi. They saw Morsi's failing. They felt that they had to support the coup covertly, silently. Yeah. You know, that's why they talked to General al-Sisi. You know, al-Sisi was Mubarak's head of military intelligence, and he was also the military attaché to Saudi Arabia. I mean, they talked to al-Sisi.
Kind of a small group.
Yeah, it is a small group, and now he's not only the defense minister and the head of the military, he's also the deputy prime minister, which says that the military is in charge.
Yeah.
They are in charge. It is a military junta with a civilian figurehead.
This is Mahdi Nazim Roya, and Mahdi, on this point about Egypt and where they were headed, I was struck by the fact that, and it's now starting to be talked about again, but when Morsi came down, what struck me at the time was that he had been really launching a rather adventurous course vis-a-vis Syria. He had said he was withdrawing all of his diplomatic recognition and his consul, etc. He also attended a rally where he called on young Egyptians to join the Salafists, or whatever they are, rebels. Very poisonous line. By the way, I mean, that's the kind of thing that presidents ought to be around the world, ought to be impeached for, right? And I understand that now the Egyptian military has announced that they don't want any part of the Syrian situation.
Well, I don't think the Egyptian people want any part of it. I mean, they're divided on their positions on Syria, but they don't want to be dragged into a foreign war. And the other thing I want to point out about Morsi's statement and the Muslim Brotherhood's position in Egypt on Syria, as well as Hezbollah. He also criticized Hezbollah for intervening to help the Syrian government. He only did that because the Gulf, his Gulf paymasters in Washington pushed him. You know, they're losing out of, they're coming to a point in the game where they have less cards to play. And getting Egypt to withdraw its diplomatic recognition was only a card. You know, as the internal pressure disappears, they've been trying to push the external pressure, saying we're going to threaten war, more sanctions, get Egypt to cut its diplomatic ties. And to be frank with you, I think Morsi only kept those diplomatic ties with Syria as a means of blackmail, as a means of blackmail to get more money from Qatar and Saudi Arabia. They were giving him money, and I think he kept the door open with the Syrians and the Iranians for that. You know, he was flirting with the Iranians. It never came out to anything. Nothing happened. But I think he used it as a way of getting more more incentives, more rewards from Washington and the Gulf states.
Well, I guess just the last part of this, Mahdi, if I could ask you, we had all these phenomena. They told us there was a spring, et cetera, but in that spring, it turned out to be a lot of Qatar money, and the Brotherhood turned up, and they told us, oh, well, this is wonderful. These are democratic people. But as you say, they've been actually losing out everywhere. Do you think that maybe this could go all the way back to Tunisia, where they claim to be all very comfortable?
I mean, we should keep our eyes on Tunisia. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood is still in place there. But they've also been, they've been talking more to different parties. I mean, I'm not saying there's a lot, that they're angels or they're not corrupt, because they are. But they've been willing to compromise more in Tunisia than any of the other places. But you're absolutely right. And I want to emphasize that Saudi money has been going in this. American know-how and support has been going into this. Military support from NATO has been going into this. You know, these Syrian rebels and so-called some of the activists that are only political have had salaries. They're getting salaries. They're getting paid. Even the American mainstream media has admitted they're getting paid. Some of them make more in a few days than they would in a year, you know? So
yes,
they're fighting for money, and there's salaries involved here. Billions of dollars have been spent on this project, and I think Qatar's lost a lot in its investment. I mean, but you can never have a, let's say, there can never be a revolution supported by Lieberman and Israel and McCain and the Saudi Arabia and the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia.
Not a lot of votes there.
Is the king of Saudi Arabia a Democrat? No, but for some reason, all these Arab springers in places like Syria have saluted him as a great Democrat, including...
They named their organizations after him, right? Some of their fighting groups, they name after the king of Saudi Arabia.
Even the March 14th Alliance, the reactionary phalange that is enemies of Hezbollah, they've been saluting the Gulf tyrants as Democrats for a long time. In fact, I remember just before the Mubarak was removed, they had a huge picture of Mubarak as a great on the Lebanese forces. And when I mean Lebanese forces, it's the Falange party, the Christian fascists there. They had a picture of them on their website, and they removed it just when Mubarak was deposed. You know, these are the type of hypocrites we're dealing with in that region.
Well, the mercenaries are kind of cynical people. Mahdi Nazemroya, the author of The Globalization of NATO, we're looking forward to your next book, Mahdi. We're very grateful you gave us the time.
Oh, thank you, Phil. It's always a pleasure to be on.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye. And that was Mahdi Nazemroya. And you can go to globalresearch.ca, find Nazim's article featured there. And, of course, you can link up to a number of articles. He has been right on top of the story, particularly the tie-in with Morsi and others.